welcome. You are listening to Red Ice Radio. I'm Henrik, and our websites, redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com, is full of radio programs. We do 3 new shows each week. We also have videos and a busy news section. We go way back to 2001, and our radio show has been going since 2006. We feature interviews, research, and analysis with the objective of questioning the official version of what we're getting from the media, our governments, and the talking heads, politicians, and the officials that are manipulating us. We focus on subversive political agendas, groups with sinister objectives designed to undermine us and get us under control. We question history, all aspects of it, especially those things that most people parrot over and over and over again. We examine the details behind the headlines and many of the important items that are not highlighted and recognized at all in some cases. Our goal is to cover the most interesting researchers that speaks about many of the most important issues. We, of course, seek accuracy and truth, and we do talk with a lot of different people, but we do not always agree with everything our guests say. But we still also enjoy having conversation with folks that we might not always agree with. This is also investigations designed to determine the validity of material, research, and claims. We recently were censored on iTunes by Apple. They removed our feed from their podcast service from every country around the world. This is a sign of what kind of world we live in. And this happens not when you speak about aliens or, Nazis running the planet, or even what people call the 1%. It happens when you begin to question the foundational aspects of the established worldview, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking about the thoughts and the opinions that most people hold that they do not even think about or question. The atrocities that go unrecognized and completely under the radar. I mean, we've talked about every conceivable conspiracy and off-the-wall stuff since 2006, and we've been on iTunes for almost as long, and it's only in the recent months, really, that we've really begun to penetrate deeper into the darkness and the forbidden country. I urge you to please take a moment and take a look at some of the recent shows that we have done and some of the topics that we've covered, and I think you'll get an idea. It's when you begin to question the more sinister aspects, the dark underbelly of the beast that it does not want you to bring attention to, that these kinds of things happen. Some people don't want to address this, they don't dare to address this, but nonetheless, when you do, this is the result. But I think this speaks volumes about where the resistance lies, what you're not, absolutely not allowed to talk about. And this should say something about what the areas of sensitivities and those who rule our world today. You know, we've always been honest and open about our desire and sincerity in questioning everything. But some things have been designated by those who rule this world today to be a no-go zone. As Voltaire said, to learn who rules over you, simply find out who you're not allowed to criticize. And this is who sets the rules today. I do hope, for the sake of intellectual honesty at least, whether you agree or not with our line of questioning, that you ask yourself why this happened and why it happened now. What is it that they don't want you to know? Don't you want to know? Today we're going to back up a bit in our topics and talk with a guest who's been with us many times before. This is known country. Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire is with us to take on the roots of the ISIS crisis. We're going to ask questions about who's behind it, how it's being used, and what is sought to be achieved in the long term. Hey, Patrick, welcome back. It's great to talk with you again. I guess you've been out for a little while, so I'm sorry to hear that, but it's great to have you back, and thank you for coming on. I know I have a little bit of a throat issue going on, so we do appreciate you taking the time talking with us today.
Yeah, I was out of action for a while, but I'm working my way back into it. It's great to be with you, Henrik.
Thank you so much. There's just an incredible amount of things going on. I don't feel overwhelmed, but just it's too much almost to deconstruct it and too much to keep up with. We have so many different situations escalating pretty quick, actually. We have, of course, the ISIS situation that have completely spiraled out of control. We have a very interesting set of, from propaganda to what I believe actually are real events when it comes to beheadings that have been coming out. I think the James Foley situation is very interesting. On top of that, there's definitely a real issue going on with ISIS, but this is, of course, being used by the Zionists and by the West. So that's one issue. Then we have the issue of what's happening in between Russia and Ukraine as well. That's completely escalating very quickly and dangerously, you know, close to breaking out in a full war, basically, with the West again being part of that. We have the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, and planes have been permitted to leave the region. One of them went up to Minnesota, up to the States, knowingly, it seems like, as well. There is the other issue of the pedophile rings of the Pakistani Muslims in Rotherham in the UK, where the officials have covered up the whole thing for fear of being called racist. And I mean, if this is not the ugliest side of political correctness, I don't know what is. But so for sure, there's no lack of things to discuss here, Patrick, and we'll see what we have time to get to. But I think we should begin with ISIS and try to deconstruct this a little bit, because there's so many angles to it. There's so many different groups that are, of course, using what has developed. And as always, as it always is, I think we have to go to the roots, try to go to the roots anyway, to try to discover what lies behind this. How have you viewed ISIS since it emerged only really a few months ago on the media's radar, of what this is about and who's behind it, Patrick?
Well, I've been following ISIS long before it hit the headlines recently, of course, with this the Islamic State of Syria, Iraq, and the Levant in Syria as part of the so-called opposition fighting against the Syrian government alongside the FSA. But it's important that people understand, it's particularly since this ISIS issue is getting wall-to-wall coverage in the U.S. media. I mean, you cannot turn, it will not turn itself off on any of the news channels, be it CNN, Fox, ABC, CBS. They're just banging on about ISIS, that ISIS is targeting the Pope, they said today. ISIS wants Lady Al-Qaeda freed from a U.S. jail. ISIS is coming to America to attack Americans. So they're really ramping up the fear. But it doesn't have the emotional hold that Al-Qaeda had after 9/11, obviously, because there hasn't been a U.S.-based terror attack or tragedy as part of the story. So where does ISIS come from? Right now, if you listen to the U.S. State Department, or if you listen to the Pentagon spokespeople like Rear Admiral Kirby or Anderson Cooper on CNN or Wolf Blitzer, they'll have you think that ISIS somehow sprung out of Syria. That's not true. ISIS is essentially, the elements of ISIS have come from two places. The first is Iraq, before the Syrian civil war. The second is Libya. So if we look back at Libya, when we saw the black Al-Qaeda flags flying over the courthouse in Benghazi in 2011 and 2012, that is essentially the first kind of sighting of that kind of group. And then we also saw the same flags flying in places in Iraq. So what happened? NATO basically allied itself with jihadist groups in order to overthrow the Gaddafi government. And one in particular leader and organizer that they had employed, his name was Abdel Hakim Belhaj, who happened to be detained in Guantanamo Bay for a number of years. And he was somehow, for unknown reasons, released, appears in Libya at the perfect time of the downfall of Gaddafi. And then he's also, well, he's now governor of Tripoli, but also organizing recruitment of fighters to transfer to Syria in 2012. There's another one named Irat Vakitov, who is from Chechnya. He was also interned in Guantanamo Bay at the same time as Belhaj. He was then released, and he is leading fighting forces in Syria, very extremist Islamic fighting forces, I might add. So you can kind of see these are the roots of ISIS. And in addition, we have a group called Front Victory, who was operating as part of the insurgency in Iraq, and I believe receiving funding probably from Saudi Arabia. And they also were moved into Syria in 2012 and 2013. So you have this this kind of movement from Libya, from Iraq as part of the insurgency, and then moved into Syria as the civil war began. The U.S. has turned a blind eye to just about everything going on with Islamic fighters in Syria because they believed it helped to mitigate the Assad government and the Syrian army's efforts to quell the opposition. So they basically turned a blind eye. They turned a blind eye to terror tourists, young kids coming from Europe and U.S. or further afield, easily trackable. They have absolutely every ability to know where these kids are coming from and where they're heading. But they turned a blind eye because they saw this as part of the effort for regime change in Syria. So again, allowing this thing to build up. And so we have the consolidation of the al-Nusra Front. That is a Saudi Arabian Prince Bandar definitely had, I believe, full control and financial control over the al-Nusra Front. They consolidated a number of terror groups into a bigger al-Nusra Front operating in Syria, and splinter groups were broken off. People moved into one group to another. Maybe one group paid more than the other. So you have this movement. Everybody, most of them are getting paid from the officer level up, for $50 a month up to $2,000 if you're a general or coordinator. And all these salaries are being paid for by Saudi Arabian financial sources and Qatar financial sources. U.S. commentators call Qatar, they call it Qatar, which is the wrong pronunciation, but unfortunately we have to suffer that when you watch U.S. Commentators like Wolf Blitzer calling it Qatar. It's really Qatar.
Yeah.
So that emirate, along with Saudi Arabia, are basically funding the ISIS crisis. So you could end the whole thing in probably about 14 days if you were to cut off funding. Both of those countries are allies of the United States and Great Britain. The United States has its central command and control based in Doha, and also the Sixth Fleet based in Doha. So it's not that we don't have very deep ties with the country of Qatar. And of course, I don't need to tell you about U.S. and British ties to Saudi Arabia and how deep those go on a political and economic level. So it's not as if we don't have some influence, but we're allowing this to happen. And you have to be skeptical of this ISIS crisis. I mean, back in the 1980s, the recruitment, open recruitment at various U.S. cities for Mujahideen to go to Afghanistan to fight, that was common.
Yep.
You had recruitment centers in places like Tucson, Arizona, and places like Seattle, Washington. You know, this is back in the 80s. So the same thing has happened with ISIS around Europe, but the recruitment is done a little more under the radar through mosques and through community, other sort of Islamic community groups. And also with the most absolutely more than likely with the involvement of informants from the intelligence agencies. They're all over the place in all these mosques and groups. So you'd be very naive to think that they're not aware and don't have a visual on all this sort of recruitment activity coming from Europe. So that's the picture we're looking at. And you know, we also have the Muslim Brotherhood really stalk the ranks of what is now ISIL and ISIS between 2012 and 2013, running recruitment activities out of Egypt. They had a Muslim Brotherhood arm active in Syria from 2010, and also working in Tunisia and Morocco. And there's a lot of fighters from that recruitment drive still active in the region. You have to remember, massive unemployment throughout these Muslim countries. A university professor makes $200 a month. So, you know, any salary from $50 to $100 a month is a good wage. And when you can pocket your wages and you can plunder your food and everything else through your conquest activities, obviously it seems like a good financial deal for a lot of people. And they just use the Islamic fundamentalist fervor as the kind of hook get the soldiers involved. And a lot of times these are not – they're basically the psychological profile of these fighters are twofold. One of them will be very disturbed, not quite all there. And then you have the other ones that are just absolute guns for hire, you know, like a gang member who'll do anything for a buck, shoot anybody, shoot any for a buck. That's what you basically have is the unstable, identity crisis, confused religious, mentally disturbed young man, and you have the mercenary. So it basically is those two.
Well, it's a really good point there, and I feel as well that the division is way too sharp between how people view the situation, as usual, I guess, to a certain extent. But I feel that there's multiple different groups that are using the situation and exacerbating it for their own purposes. I mean, I think we have at least, I think, 400 Britons of among the estimated, this stage might be more than that, but about 2,000, you know, Europeans, and I put that within quotation marks, of course, because these are immigrant Europeans who are fighting for the Islamic State. There has been outpouring from, you know, from England, from Germany, even from Norway, and we had people from Sweden actually joining the opposite side and fighting ISIS down in Iraq, for example. And this is also something that we have brought into Europe. It's something that exists there. There is, as you say, a violently extreme, ruthless portion to this that are attracted to organizations like ISIS because of the reasons you just gave. But even if we begin to question the roots of the organization, or let's say the funding, or even what alleged NSA documents revealed a while back, Snowden alleges that the leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, sorry, I'm mispronouncing that, that he was actually trained by Israeli Mossad, you know? So the question there is, okay, so there is an origin point that might be utilized and manipulated by Israel, by the Mossad, by NATO forces, by the West in general, who seek to use this as a measure, not only to gain in Syria, but I think just keep perpetual, you know, bases in Iraq and saying that, oh my God, this region is completely, you know, in it's a debacle. We have to stay there. We have to get in with more people in Libya. And then that exacerbates the situation, and you have consequent more fighters being drawn to the situation. And you also have a consequent wave of immigrants leaving these countries, in some cases even going to the very countries, Europe and the West and America, that have been part in invading these countries. So the question is, what kind of relationships are you building and creating in this situation? To me, it seems like an ultimate just create as much chaos as you can, and everybody's using the situation to their advantage. So there's just an endless amount of tentacles. But I guess my main point here is that many people say that, oh, well, it's just being used by the West, and it's just a front and a fraud kind of thing, so therefore it doesn't really kind of matter, it doesn't exist, it doesn't pose a threat. But I would definitely argue the other way around. They're still doing what they're doing, no matter who's actually pulling the strings, right?
Sure. I mean, first off, al-Baghdadi most likely is a double agent. And I think a lot of people with a sharp mind will sort of not disagree with that. You can tell by the timing of his release from the U.S. custody and his lofty position within this so-called ISIS movement. But the main thing about ISIS that people got to understand is they cannot govern. ISIS or ISIL, whatever you want to call it, let's call it ISIS for now, they cannot govern. They would not be accepted as a municipal or a governing body anywhere in the Middle East, anywhere. Okay, if you polled Arabs around the world and you asked them how many of you want to live in Saudi Arabia, I think it's like 2%, because they don't like the restrictive lifestyle and the Sharia, you know, the intense Sharia culture you have in Saudi Arabia. They just don't want it. So that, when we train the minds of Americans and British and Europeans to think that, somehow, you know, all Muslims want to implement Sharia law, which is a complete load of bull. But that is the sort of brainwashing that takes place on our side. But, ISIS cannot govern. All they are is a spoiler. And they're serving a purpose right now. They have a role, absolutely, without a doubt. I I would venture to say I'd be very surprised if Israeli intelligence operatives were not placed in high positions within this movement. And also they have benefited greatly, I would go so far as to say enabled by the U.S. Airlift of weapons and training in Jordan, and also the stuff going on similar in Turkey to help overthrow the Syrian government. So they have benefited, they have been enabled. And the thing that really sparked this, by the way, and this kind of went unreported in the West, in August of last year, there were three huge jailbreaks in Iraq. The first one was on July 22nd, and 500 inmates of these fighters that we're looking at now were sprung from two different prisons in Iraq. Al-Qaeda claimed credit, but they somehow managed to take out 120 Iraqi guards and SWAT forces, in a matter of minutes, which to me is not an Al-Qaeda operation, could not pull off such a thing. 5 days later, on July 28th, a security spokesman admitted to the Libyan Herald that 1,200 Islamic fighters escaped a prison in Benghazi. And the third one took place the following day on July 29th, and 250 Pakistani Taliban prisoners walked out of a prison there, not before killing 12 policemen, cutting the throats of four Shiite prisoners on the way out. So there you have, up to 2,000 potential jihadist fighters all sprung within a week. Now, what are the odds of that happening without some outside intervention?
Right. Yes. Excellent timing, of course. Yeah.
I have to ask that question. And we look down the timeline as well. We have to look at this is also a defining point. When the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003, you remember Sadr's army. This was a Shiite militia. This was the big feared obstacle the U.S. had, and they were having to negotiate with after the Iraqi army stood down after being paid off and whatnot, running away. Sadr's army is a tough Shiite militia in Iraq. The U.S. spent the next 10 years dismantling, going after, and trying to basically dismantle this militia in Iraq, which had very strong bases in Western Iraq. So you have to look at this. We spent billions of dollars of our U.S. taxpayer money to transfer these militia members into police and security forces. Okay. And our soldiers training them and telling them not to be loyal to their militia. And you've probably seen some of the footage of this online. It's absolutely comical.
Yeah.
But that's what we did, was to disarm the Iraqi population, take away the militia, and leave it with a kind of a useless police force. Now, if that militia was allowed to exist, ISIS would not have had a chance. They would have been routed. They would have been routed, and they wouldn't have been able to step foot in Iraq. That's a fact.
Mm-hmm.
And it was because of what the U.S. did to break down and dismantle that culture. And the Middle East has a strong culture of militias, and that goes down to tribal, family, tribal, and village affiliations. And it's not so much a religious thing, more of a tribal thing. And our stated goal and objective in dominating Iraq was to get rid of that. And we're doing the same thing, trying to do the same thing in Afghanistan as well. And what happens when you do that? You leave a void, an absolute void. So if you then withdraw your big heavy equipment and soldiers and your Western system of viceroy government, you absolute chaos will fill that void.
Exactly. Everyone rushes in and try to fill that place, you know, and I think, just as you pointed out, ISIS, ISIL, all these organizations are there as a kind of a bulwark. They're like the fist that is coming in and to kind of clear the way. That's how I see it, in a way. And the question is, of course, Okay, I don't want to jump ahead of myself here, and please back up if you need to, Patrick, but what is going to end up in its place, if you will, once and if or whatnot this is kind of taken care of, what kind of organizations is going to kind of, I guess, back up and seem less extreme, but perhaps nonetheless made a couple of steps forward towards that direction. This is how they do things as well, right? They release something which is overtly extreme, and by the time you back up, you know, it's two moves forward, one back, right? You still have advanced a little bit. So that's another big question in this.
Well, one of the jobs of ISIS, and I don't know where they get their marching orders, but is also to ethnically cleanse Christians.
And Kurds and Yazidis and people like that.
Yeah, the Kurds, it's not going to be an easy job there. But certainly Christians have been pushed out of the Middle East methodically and systematically for a number of years. The Israeli occupation has driven a huge number of Palestinian Christians out of Palestine over the last 30 years. Mm-hmm. And just during the short period of the Muslim Brotherhood had power in Cairo, huge amount of Coptic Christians were targeted, churches were burned, people were killed. And that was not reported because at that time, our White House and John McCain and Lindsey Graham were the biggest supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood. So they had to turn a blind eye to the violence against Christians.
It's amazing. And it shows what fakes they are as well, posing as Christians and everything else. I mean, it's just extraordinary. And in this case, you'd think that the Western world would run to their rescue, right? But they turned their backs on it and just covered up, hush hush, you know? Very suspicious.
Sure. And during the Lebanese Civil War, which was a long, bloody, and very destructive war in Lebanon, which is mainly Israel is responsible for making that war vicious. Hundreds of thousands of Christians fled Lebanon after that to Australia, South America, Mexico, and the United States and Europe. So, again, another exodus of Christians. So you look at this pattern, say now in Iraq, you look at this pattern, exodus of Christians from the Middle East, that there has to be an overarching agenda there. It's not a coincidence. It's being done by design. And there is a reason for that. And one of the reasons is, I believe, it's to really polarize the Middle East into basically, Muslims, Arabs, and a very small minority of Jews mm-hmm. in Israel. And we'll get to Israel later, but yep. So there's definitely something, going on there that you cannot ignore. But here's the bottom line with regards to ISIS in Iraq, the timing of it. Kurdistan had just successfully shipped its first order of oil, I believe back in May. And very soon after, we have this ISIS crisis. So the GCC countries, we're talking mainly led by Saudi Arabia and Qatar, they cannot accept anything less than full domination in that region with regards to energy. So that's why they've worked in concert with the U.S. and Israel to keep Iran out of the game. And they're now trying to keep Iraq out of the game because they know the power Iraq has with the energy that it's sitting on.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want the competition. They want to keep the price of oil high. They don't want the political influence that could build as a result of the economic improvement in Iraq. Ditto for Iran. And secondly, there is a potential Shiite bridge of influence between Syria, Iraq, and Iran. And that cannot stand if you know Saudi Arabians, if you talk to them and you listen to them. They cannot stand anything Shiite. So they see this as something that they cannot contend with. So they're on board with any program, any agenda that will break up any sort of Shiite influence. So you saw the outgoing Prime Minister Maliki leaving office recently, driven out of office in Iraq, and he committed a few mortal sins. The first one was he was supporting President Assad in his war on terror. And the West and the Saudis and everyone else did not approve of that. And I believe he was punished for that. He also was the first person to strike an ISIS convoy using Iraqi Air Force along the Syrian border, and this was back in June. And I believe this made a lot of people very upset, and they upped the stakes there to remove him. And he, of course, he's a Shiite leader. He can't be entering into major negotiations with the Iranian leadership or Syria for that matter. So they've removed him out of the game, basically, and that is pretty obvious what went on there. But, you know, you have this pattern emerging. A lot of it is about, of course, energy and gas and the domination of those markets and the things that go with that domination, which are political power and also nationalist will or other alliances that might exist with the West. So we have to look at those things as sort of the overarching drivers here of what's going on. And then on down on the ground, people like ISIS will move and do what they do. But definitely they are being bankrolled by mainly Saudi and Qatar. So it's quite hypocritical that a U.S. leader could stand up scratching their head like this is some sort of unknown beast, when in fact the very emirs and kings that he's bowing to when he's over there on a state visit have the ability to fund or defund these terrorist brigades that are wreaking havoc throughout the region.
Well, this is, sorry to interrupt here, but that's what's so weird here, because I wonder how many people within ISIS itself believe, you know, that they might, we might end up in power, let's keep pushing kind of thing. I mean, again, there's a lot of different mentalities behind here, but ultimately, their participation is based on their own stupidity, really, and where they don't realize that they are being used, while, of course, a few within the organization might realize, and they don't mind, or they like the money, or they do have ulterior motives, who knows, right? But ultimately, the work they're doing is like encouraged and sponsored ultimately, because this is the end result that they want. The chaos program, you know, entails too much peace and prosperity. It's not good for business. They also need to have a continuous flow of, you know, immigrants coming into Europe, right, to create conflict on religious, cultural, and ethnic basis also. So this serves so many different purposes and reasons for what they're seeking to control right now. And I see, anyway, that Israel plays a major central, you know, as a spider in that web for sure, you know?
Yeah, sure it does. I mean, yeah, you're right about the, you know, maintaining that level of instability and chaos, which is essential because within that, only certain people can flourish and thrive within that environment, of course.
Yep.
And those will not be democratic nation states, especially fledgling ones in the region. So, but, you know, ISIS is very much a marketing phenomenon and a PR phenomenon. I mean, I personally have seen a number of early on fake photoshopped images with mass graves and mm-hmm. a lot of people being lined up. And then you see the offcut shot where the guy gets out of line and then walks backwards.
Yeah, did you see the recent one? It was 250 people, was it, that was lined up? And again, it was the same issue as with the James Foley video. They did not actually show it. And again, it doesn't mean – I mean, I've seen some pretty gnarly beheadings that I wish I didn't actually see, but it was as I was doing research on it and questioning, like, wait a minute, okay, what is real here, what is not, you know, because – there are certainly definitely fake ones, and those who are, they veer off quite extraordinarily from how the other ones look and appear to me, to be honest. But the last one here, I think that's one you're referring to, 250 soldiers were captured, they were dragged out to the desert. But then even the kicker in the article, I think it was out of Daily Mail in England, they said, like, oh, too horrible to see. The video fades to black, and then we see them kind of lying dead. Like, what? Okay, well, if they want to show this and put terror into people, wouldn't they actually want them to see this stuff? So we're left kind of, well, use the pun here, in the dark, you know, because they fade to black in certain of these cases, and we don't know what's fake, because they can do quite a bit with, you know, CGI and film work these days, as we know, right?
Sure, yeah. If you question things and you actually look at forensic, what's in front of your face, which unfortunately, if you work in mainstream media, that most people, they don't do that. They're not trained to do that. So, you know, all of the sleuths and the hard little diggers out here in the alternative media will be doing that sort of work. But if you look at real forensics, you can see what's fake, what's been staged. And there's tons and tons of this ISIS stuff that is just blatantly badly staged. You know, basketball shoes, soldiers in pure white basketball shoes. I mean, just crazy stuff that is just completely unrealistic. Victims lined up wearing the exact same T-shirts and trousers and shoes. And just completely unbelievable stuff. And what is part of the campaign to create the fear of ISIS in the early days. And if you look at the James Foley video, again, if I'm a police detective, I don't know if James Foley's alive or dead because I don't have a body.
Yeah,
all I have
exactly.
is a YouTube. All I have is a YouTube video. And that YouTube video doesn't even show a beheading. It shows someone with a penknife, someone with a London Cockney accent, with a penknife. Looks like they're beginning to cut off James Foley's throat. And then it just completely changes to a still image of what could or could not be James Foley's head sitting on a corpse. So there is no conclusive proof of any murder there. But yet it's run without question through the national media and used as a rallying cry. And what is the timing of that rallying cry is for, which is now dominating the whole of the U.S. media, which is U.S. now needs to conduct airstrikes into Syria. And this is a bit of a sleight of hand because, as we all know, the U.S. Worked very hard with Britain to try to create a fake chemical weapons scenario 1 year ago in order to have a green light for a major air bombardment of Syria, military targets. So that didn't happen, obviously, because the people did not give any consent to that. They just didn't buy it. So they had to put it on the shelf. So this is how they've gotten back in. And how they've gotten back in is they're saying that ISIS came from Syria. And earlier in the show, I explained that that's not true. But anyway, that because ISIS resides in Syria, Marie Harf is the assistant deputy spokesperson for the U.S. State Department. And she said a quote that is absolutely unbelievable. A couple of days ago, I was watching the briefing. She said, well, based on their actions, the Syrian government are really responsible for allowing ISIS to flourish.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yeah.
Pure backwards lie. And this is from the U.S. State Department. So this tells you right here, we know there's a lot of deception going on, a lot of blatant lying. So they want to have airstrikes in Syria. Every single news channel is promoting this right now. And they can't because Syria is a sovereign country. They're completely ignoring the Syrian government as if it doesn't exist. Well, I'll tell you what, the only country that's been battling terror in the Middle East for the last few years has been Syria. No country has shed more blood in the war on terror in the last few years. And the U.S. Has never once spoke up about the jihadist brigades in Syria because they thought that they were going to mitigate Syrian armed forces and help the Free Syrian Army, which the U.S. is openly backing and arming and funding and so forth. All of the things, of course, that it's accusing Russia of doing in the east of the Ukraine and how that's
exactly.
They're doing the exact same thing
yeah.
the last 3 years in Syria and saying that that's okay. Ignore that. We're on the side of right because for some reason Bashar al-Assad has to go.
Yeah.
We don't know why. But he has to be removed from government. Well, here's the thing. If you really wanted to flush out ISIS, the natural, logical thing to do, if the world was based on logic and some sort of ethical framework, it would be for the U.S. to approach, along with the Iraqi government, to approach the Assad government, sit down at the table and said, how are we going to flush these guys out?
Mm-hmm. Let's
do it. If that's the goal. But to see, the U.S. has a double agenda, a double entendre going on. They're going to use the airstrikes to hit Syrian targets, Syrian military targets.
That's right.
and they're going to try to open up corridors for the Free Syrian Army and also to take out Syrian military assets. And the U.S., as we know, if they ever misfire or bomb something by accident, they can always raise their hand and say, oh, we're sorry. But if they can black out any of those misfires in U.S. Western media, not report it, then effectively no one will know about it outside of the Syrian media, you see. So that is the plan. So the main plan is to take out, and has been since last year, is to take out the Syrian Air Force, all 250 fighters, and also any of their airports and facilities. And that is basically an Israeli-sponsored effort.
Exactly, yes.
Which came through the Foreign Policy Initiative and some of the Center for Middle East Strategic Studies and some of these think tanks in Washington who basically sponsored the policy papers for that. Henry Jackson Society in the UK, same thing. John McCain's fake PhD intern was involved in that very sort of policy paper. So that is Israel's. That's what Israel wants out of the Syrian situation. They want to eliminate the Syrian Air Force. That's what they wanted from last year. They still want that. Okay.
Yep.
So that's still on the table, and so we have to look at that and say these are still live plays going on with regards to Syria.
It's the few stabilizing elements that they do have left in the Middle East that they seek to remove, just as they sought to remove Saddam or Gaddafi, as you mentioned before, and of course to give way for even more chaos and whatnot, and who knows, maybe even that is designed in itself to lead to an ultimate goal, which might be a full on fledged war, let's say, between the West and Islam. It might be to basically increase the support for Israel as being like, oh my God, they're being threatened, we have to step in, and here we go. Europe and Islam, or America and Islam, are now at each other's throats, and that's it, while Israel is standing on the sidelines, rubbing their hands together. Ha ha ha, here we go, right? So there's a lot of different things that people need to keep in mind here. But as you were talking about some of this in terms of the fake stuff, let's just quickly, if we can, analyze what potentially might be going on in the background of this. Because if we take the rapper, what was his name again? El Jini, I think his real name was Abdel Majed Abdel Bari or Bari, in the UK, who was accused of, or he's allegedly the one who actually did the beheading of James Foley. Again, we don't know if this is true or not.
Yeah, but the voice sounded very similar to me. To Danny Dayem, Syrian Danny, who was the face of the Syrian opposition back in 2012, but it was actually a British agent who disappeared off the face of the earth once he was outed, doing fake reports for CNN and staged, stuff. So that's who the voice sounded like, and definitely same eyes and everything. So that's... Something for the researchers to go. You could probably pull the voice print and look at the waveform of his voice there and match it to another interview that might be on YouTube of his. But yeah, go ahead. I've heard the story about this alleged Islamic rapper.
Right, exactly. Okay, and let's say, and it doesn't really matter. The point applies anyway if it is indeed Syrian Danny, and I do remember that. That's another one of these really interesting stories. I remember I recommend people Google that if they're not familiar with it. But nonetheless, whoever it may be, these are people who are extracted off the face of the earth, really, for the lack of a better term. And I wonder what goes on in the backdrop of all this if we take this particular angle into consideration and look at even someone like, let's say, James Foley, that he isn't actually beheaded. We have the same debacle with... Daniel, what was his last name again in 2000?
Berg.
Yes, exactly. Same thing. And huge questions about how this was done. What do you think, if we look at the backdrop of that, what do you think, let's assume that it doesn't happen, it is fake. What happens to these people and how do they live their lives consequently? Protected somewhere on an island and everything is good for them? I mean, unless they change their faces, right, and do reconstructive surgery or something, they can't go back to some of these areas where they've been where they would be recognized, correct? So these are willing participants, and they might then potentially get a heck of a lot of money to participate in this fraud and theatrics, right?
Sure. Well, the Berg beheading, which was big news back in the early days of the Iraq War, the Berg beheading, Berg's profile was that he was a entrepreneur running around a war zone installing telecommunications. I mean, had a perfect CIA profile, or possibly a CIA stroke Mossad, because he was Jewish. So then the beheading video was out. Looked like a bunch of very, very tall men wearing white shoes who didn't appear to be Arab, although they had lavas covering their faces. But they didn't actually show Berg being beheaded. And there was talk of green screen and lots of other things. So there was that one. A similar beheading video came out of Syria where they cut as soon as the thing hits the throat, then they cut and they zoom in and you can't see anything. And again, with the Foley video, no beheading shown. So there's no proof that James Foley was beheaded. Absolutely zero. You couldn't close this murder case. It'd still be an open case. But in the world of politics and media and fantasy and what I call now mainstream conspiracy theory industry, anything goes, basically. So in the case of Berg could have very well been an agent. So if he was an agent, that basically that beheading was the closing of his file for whatever that was. And then he'd be moved on in a kind of witness protection program scenario or redeployed on another assignment. Who knows what James Foley's affiliations were. I'd be surprised if he did not have some contact or liaison with U.S. intelligence agencies. I'd be very surprised if that was the case, especially at his age, especially in the areas he was working under. So, but the fact remains, we can speculate about that, but the fact remains there is no proof that James Foley is dead.
Right, exactly. Yet his parents are up, they're up there, they're crying, for all they know, of course, that's all they've been told, and that's probably the most likely scenario. And who knows, maybe even James Foley would be, maybe he is being held against his will. Maybe he was actually sacrificed. Maybe he was taken out even. We don't know, right?
Possibly, yeah. It's all possible. It's still an open case, Henry. And it's just frustrating that the world would just believe anything. And now we have, we're in a very strange paradigm now where our governments and our authorities are putting YouTube videos up and saying that this is sort of definitive proof. I can only point out MH17 as a perfect example, as all the evidence against the Russian rebels for shooting down that plane were basically badly edited, faked YouTube videos. That was put out by the Ukrainian government. So I want to get on a tangent on that subject maybe for another show. And I've also made some pretty interesting discoveries about that recently, which I can share with you on another conversation. But this is the times we live in. I mean, since when, does our Secretary of State, our foreign secretary will get up and say we have open sourced evidence from social media? He's touting Twitter and Twitter things and YouTube videos as a pretext to go to war.
Yeah.
I mean, this is insane. We've reached a point of complete breakdown within our own governing structures where there's zero accountability of anything when social media is being used to drive foreign policy. I just don't understand how this has come to this point.
Well, exactly. I mean, this is the new reality now, where people are being... They could be arrested for what they say on Twitter. Police breaks down doors for Facebook posts. I mean, that's the world we're living in now. And it doesn't really matter if it's true or if it's a joke or whatever it is, right? And this is what's happening. And people are, of course, and the governments in particularly, are using this. And again, it doesn't matter if it is the reality or not. The consequences of this, they are real. And that is happening. And that's what matters. And they use it in whatever measure they can, Patrick. So, I mean, it's scary, but it's the reality we're faced with, you know?
Sure. They will break down your door for a Facebook post. But if you're using Twitter or Facebook for ISIS recruitment videos and showing people's, guts being ripped out and hearts being cut out, because they didn't submit to ISIS. Those are going on social media. That's all okay.
Yeah.
That's all fine. They even have their marketing and their T-shirts and everything else. And meanwhile, our government in Washington is, you know, getting Congress to approve $500 million to go to the Syrian opposition and another $5 billion requested by Obama last May for who knows what, CIA, FSA training facilities, who knows how many ISIS fighters are going through that. They're not all carrying membership cards, so you don't know who's who.
Yep.
Okay?
Yep.
And I think that we are hugely enabling this crisis. And I think there is a little bit of staged theater involved. If you look at how it's being picked up, especially by the right-wing media, especially by Fox, the circus aspect of ISIS, I can see that this reminds me so much of the Al-Qaeda theater, which came right out of 9/11, and the fake bin Laden videos. And they're talking now again about raising the terror threat to severe, bringing back all those old chestnuts from 14 years ago and trying to revitalize them with this new Islamic threat.
Well, exactly. The government fear factor is at it again, you know, and it's just in time for another 9/11, you know, anniversary. And then, as I said before, to harken back to that, at the same time, we do have, you know, extremist factions within Europe that are attracted to this. Britain has become a breeding ground for joinment. I think 15% of the French people were, you know, happy to back ISIS and militants and everything else. So if this is somehow to create an ultimate antagonistic, you know, kind of scenario and relationship in some capacity, if this is to really the beginning of a new world war, what have you, the task here that we're facing, you know, whatever the pawns on the chessboard, however they are moving, right? The task here is to topple the leadership, the hijacked foreign policy within the United States, within Europe. What kind of influence does AIPAC hold on American foreign policy? What kind of hold do they have on NATO and the European Union? And that's really where the challenge lies, because again, all of this stuff that's happening is not from the perspective of the people, something that they support. Sure, they might be manipulated by what they see on the media, but ultimately they wouldn't be on this page if they weren't shown all this propaganda. So that, I mean, that's got to be our ultimate task, right? To topple the leadership and take control of our governments again.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. That is the number one task, but also to take charge of our reality. So we have to become smarter and continue to educate ourselves about what something is and what something is not. And, you know, another example is, you know, again, this idea of disarming and eliminating militia in Iraq. You can then transpose this into America with this particular presidency's obsession with gun control and trying to disarm or severely restrict, gun ownership in the United States. The same exact thing. If you look at Lebanon, look how much demonization has been put on Hezbollah for how many years. I mean, I can't even count. What is Hezbollah? All Hezbollah was, it started as a self-defense militia because Israel occupied South Lebanon. And they didn't give up, and they ended up kicking him out. And Hezbollah then morphed into a political organization. And they still have the militia element. And guess what? If you took Hezbollah out of Lebanon, ISIS could run amok.
Right. Yeah.
Through most of the country, not Beirut, but through, you know, especially the rural areas. But you take Hezbollah out of there, and the extremities of Lebanon are defenseless. That's why they want to demonize and get rid of Hezbollah. This is the same reason why they wanted to demonize and get rid of the Shiite militia in Iraq. Because they knew the power that had in terms of they will protect their neighborhoods, their villages, door to door. They'll do that job, and they, like they've done for hundreds of years. And that's part of our agenda, is to create these demilitia police states where basically, and where terror groups like this can basically run amok like pirates did, you know, 150 years ago,
And
pillaging and plundering at will. And, when is the king going to send a detachment? Oh, it's not coming. Oh, too bad. So, you know, you can see the criminal atmosphere is able to fester and thrive with this new world order.
Yeah. And that's the point, right? Again, that's the chaos program. That is exactly what they want. And they'll do anything to kind of, you know, make that happen and enforce that. And in that situation, you know, people are kind of pacified or they're taken into a position where they basically have to look towards authority to solve the situation, you know, for them. And I think as long as, you know, we are in their countries, they're in our countries kind of situation, this is never going to get better in any capacity. It's about, I mean, the ultimate solution here, if there was genuine people in power that wanted this, would be to pull out as much as possible, stop meddling in other countries' business, and let them settle the score and sort things out. What I fear now, though, of course, is that it's been such a Gordian knot, because it's been spun up in each other, and so even if, as bad as things are with the you know, America and NATO and everything else being in some of these Middle Eastern countries, it might be true, as you said, if they would just pull out entirely, that wouldn't necessarily solve the situation either, at least not initially, right? It's been so embedded for such a long time that it's like, how do you remove yourself from that equation without having everything fall on top of you like a you know, house of cards or something?
Well, you know, I would say it couldn't be any worse than what we have right now. Look at all the billions of dollars that we've spent building up organizations like NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which has nothing to do with the North Atlantic anymore, of course. But building up organizations like NATO, all the contributions from the member countries, all of the tax dollars. Look at all the wealth that has been pumped into organizations like NATO. And what good has it done in terms of security? What good has it done in terms of prosperity? NATO has not delivered security. Okay? What's delivered security has been economic cooperation, has been cultural exchange, better understanding, and also economic reform. Look at the Soviet Union, for instance. You know, the reformation of the Soviet Union was one of the greatest movements for security the world had ever seen for quite a long time. And now look what they've done to Russia, which is NATO has forced itself into Kiev, into the Ukraine, has embedded its intelligence agencies and all its tentacles into that country in order to agitate Russia. It's brought everything backwards. NATO was designed as a balancing power, some kind of a mitigating force to balance Europe and the East. And right now it's become an aggressor. It's basically moving in the same direction that the Nazis moved during the Second World War.
Well, you know, all of this is like, it's such an incredible scenario of where we find ourselves after the Second World War. And we're living in the post-world allied, you know, victory times, and history has been written by the victors. And I mean, this is, I think it doesn't always apply, but I mean, 180 degrees in the situation, what they say is not what they mean, and what they mean is not what they say, you know. And in this case, we are living in the times of those who are seeking destabilization and chaos, because they thrive on it at every turn. And while we're grappling and trying to, you know, get a hold of the situation, including even our own, you know, lives to a certain degree, this is just like a downward spiral. And the big question, you know, is here, of course, okay, how do we begin to repair anything, you know, like this? Because my God, we've seen so much incredible murder and mayhem throughout human history in the 20th century specifically, and it's easy to see that echoes of this are kind of coming back, Patrick, if you will, you know.
Yes, I believe that's true to a large extent, but I also believe that this is true. I believe that more than any time in history, we've never had such a huge amount of brainwashed, completely asleep people, sections of the population. But we've also never had the amount of people who are awake, very street smart and aware. And what you have now is, I believe, the people ginning up the destabilization, running that industry. And it is an industry, by the way. It's not just policy. It's an industry. The people running that are becoming exposed, not that unlike Caligula.
Right. Yeah. Let's marry the horse. Yeah.
Yeah. Just complete. They're now becoming completely over the top, totally reactionary, unable to sell anything seriously, and building some of the biggest farces the world has ever seen, and trying to do it in full view as if it's normal. And, you know, eventually that is, what took down Roman society and ate itself out from within, was that sort of detachment from reality that the leadership had from the peasants or from the people who were actually doing the work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's what we're seeing today in a similar way. I think this is definitely, it's like Caligula 2.0. And at some point, a lot of people are going to wake up and realize when they actually push that button too far. There are people that are stupid enough to fall for, you know, any false flag, any theatrical production of ISIS. They believe everything they watch on Fox News, everything Megyn Kelly says they believe, everything Bill O'Reilly says they believe, and that's it. They're just not smart enough to see through the the narratives that are given to them. But
and then there's there's another force which thinks every single event is everyone is an actor. Nothing is real. Nothing's really happening in the world. And we're stuck in these two extremes, right? There's a conspiracy of conspiracies always out there that are floating around, and nothing really kind of goes anywhere from there, right? You can't really resolve any of the situation because it's all just fake, right?
Yeah, that's a dead end as well. That extremity is a dead end. The only way forward is that you have to be educated. You know, you have to be an educated man or a woman, and you have to educate yourself, and you have to be able to connect the dots, and you have to be able to put things into context. That's what the news media does not want you to do ever. That is not what they will teach you. In political science, in university, they will not teach you context. In their world, in the world of politics, in the world of White House press briefings, everything is just a random series of events, and you just go from point to point to point, and there's no logic to it, and we just react and follow the bouncing ball. There is no context at all. That's what they want you to believe. The reality is the opposite. It is all context. It is all history. All the evidence is there. It's like a trail of breadcrumbs. All you have to do is start following it. You start from the present and you work your way back. Or you start from far back and you work your way forward. And this is what so many are unable to do in media positions, highly paid media positions, and also in politics. They refuse to do this. And so they will just take the pre-packaged reality, whatever is the crisis du jour, and they'll run with that. And all the opportunists will then come on like little parasites, whether they're in the arms industry or they're in the energy industry or whatever industry. And they'll go along with wherever that bouncing balls are going and see where they can profit. So that's kind of the crux of it. So education, being smart, you know, and any man, you know, back thousands of years to survive, he had to be smart. He had to be a little bit smarter than the next guy. And I'm afraid to say, to navigate this matrix, you've got to be a little bit smarter than the next guy.
Yeah, exactly. Well, ain't that the truth? And we are definitely in a place now where we have lots of low IQ and dysgenics at best, you know. But I know that there are or that we are and have been lied to on a monumental scale, and that people are unfortunately not savvy to get to the real history because they don't know what, you know, sources to seek that actually are not written by the victors and those who rule the world. And this is, of course, an extremely difficult process to go through. And in some cases, it's so monumental that they can't just kind of get over that threshold, Patrick. But let's take a break here and pick up in a little bit because we have much more to discuss. I'm going to see if there's anything more we should talk to when it comes to ISIS. But I definitely want to get your take a little bit on what's going on in Russia a little bit more deeply there. We have the Ebola thing. We have the Rotham thing as well and a number of other things. We'll see what we can get to here. But give us all the details, Patrick, and what's up here next for you on the website. If you have anything in particular coming up, I know that you've been recuperating a little bit, but give us the details.
The website is 21stcenturywire.com. That's 21stcenturywire.com, and that's the website. I haven't done a lot in the media in the last month, and I'm kind of easing my way back into it. But that's where we've got some good stuff up there periodically, and we hope that readers out there think that it's a little bit deeper and a little bit more interesting than some of the other websites.
Very good. 21stcenturywire.com. Links up on the website. Stay with us, Patrick. We'll be right back with more.
Darkness, darkness, be my pillow. Take my head, let me sleep in the coolness of your shadow, in the silence of your dreams. Darkness, darkness, hide my yearning for the things that cannot be me. Keep my mind towards the things I cannot see now, towards the things I cannot see now, the things I cannot see now. Darkness, darkness, long and lonesome, each day brings me here. I have found the edge of sadness. I have known the depths of fear. Darkness, darkness, be my blanket. Cover me with the endless night.
Friday, folks. We have a second hour coming up with Patrick Henningsen. Next, we're going to talk more about ISIS, Israel, the Zionist objectives in the long term. We'll talk about the Russia-Ukraine situation and the incursion into Syria under the excuse of what ISIS is doing right now. We spare you from commercial interruptions and website ads. We are listener-supported. And to catch the next hour and all previous programs in their entirety and all archived shows way back to 2006, almost 900 programs, please go to redicemembers.com and sign up for a membership. We have subscriptions from 3 months up to 2 years. It's only €5 per month, but any currency works. Coming up, we have Gordon Kennedy on the Guanches, the white Indians of the Canary Islands. We're also going to talk with Nora Gedgaudas about the paleo diet. And later we have David Eberhard, Mike King, the Joy Camp guys, John DeNugent, and many more. Stay with us. We'll be right back with Patrick Henningsen. Thank you for listening.